Bismillah, alhamdulillah, salatu wassalamu ala rasulillah wa alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. I suppose this is rather an untidy sort of footnote to some of the things I was saying earlier today, as I speak for about half an hour, trying to draw our attention to the only significant alternative to Islamic education, which is that of the modern secular Western paradigm. Looking at some of its roots and exploring ways in which it might resemble or might rival the Islamic model. I suppose one should start by observing that the West is, of course, a composite civilization, much more so than Islamic civilization ever was. There was always the method of the Greeks present in, for instance, Islamic medicine, certain aspects of Islamic theology, Islamic logic. But nonetheless, the, if you like, Semitic ingredient was always far more central and significant for Muslim civilization than it was for Christendom. And classical Christian, that is to say pre-18th century writers on the subject of education, the people who laid the very different foundations for what education has now become in the modern world, acknowledged that really they were stirring into this particular recipe three different ingredients. Firstly, there was Greek, particularly its theory of knowledge, the epistemology of Aristotle in particular. Also Aristotle's thoughts, Plato's thoughts on systematic education, on aesthetics, the theory of beauty, and also ethics. All of these things came together and were integrated by early medieval Western thinkers into what became the curriculum in the West. Second ingredient was the legacy of ancient Rome, particularly ideas of statecraft and law and good government. And the third ingredient, in some respects the least prominent, was religion, the Judeo-Christian story of morality and of faith. Ostensibly the most significant ingredient, but often in practice somewhat secondary. And this synthesis of Greece and Rome and the Hebrews continued to inform classifying models of Western education almost until our own day. So the traditional British public school, for instance, would invoke these three dimensions in creating the educated Englishman. Now, around about 120 years ago, all of this started to change. And it might be interesting to reflect here on the stages in which this transformation in the West vision of education has unfolded. Because it seems to have undertaken a sea change every 100 years. Historians have noted how inconvenient this is from the perspective of those who use the Gregorian calendar, in that usually the sea change gathers momentum about 20 years before the turn of each century. Now, from our point of view, it's actually very convenient because it mirrors very closely the Hijri calendar. We might say that at the dawn of the 12th century, of the 13th century, the beginning of the 13th century, we really start to see that the beginnings of the decline of the classic medieval Christian synthesis in education, of course mirroring larger transformations in society and philosophy and religion as well. So that round about the year 1200 in our calendar, we start to get the first voices raised explicitly against classical forms of religion and also against a kind of classicizing Hellenistic tendency. Edmund Burke would be one example of this. On the European continent, the most clear expression of this at around the beginning of the 13th century was the French Revolution, with its radical denial of the traditional European Christian story. In England and in America, by extension, another key figure here was Gibbon, with his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which was one of the first works really to challenge the educative value of Christianity. His question was, did Christianity actually contribute to the collapse of that great unified civilization? Was it in fact an educative force at all? So at the beginning of the 13th century, you can say this is the change that was happening in the West. The beginning of the 14th century, around the 1880s, we find another major transformation taking place. And here, Darwinism is really gaining momentum for the first time. Freud is beginning to articulate his very secular deconstruction of the human spirit as being basically a product of the basest passional forces in the human subconscious. We find the development of forms of modernism in art and the beginnings of the Impressionist movement and the move away from the idea that art has to be a celebration of beauty and symmetry, because that's the nature of the world, given its divine origin, and towards a more chaotic, revised, pessimistic view of the natural order and of the human form, culminating with people like Cézanne, for instance, and the high Impressionist period. Also, at the beginning of the 1300s, we find communism. Karl Marx writing Das Kapital, and communism and hardline forms of socialism are really gathering strength in the West. This is the time of Bernard Shaw's first writings, the time of William Morris's conversion to socialism, the Fabian movement getting underway. Not just communism, but also socialism in the real red traditional sense. And that goes on for 100 years, and then all of that falls apart as well. There was a skepticism about the skepticism. And we find that at the beginning of the 1400s, communism suddenly collapses. Berlin Wall comes down in, 1989, but the rot has been clear for at least 10 years following the Soviet debacle in Afghanistan and Gorbachev's reforms, perestroika, glasnost, and the rest. We find postmodernism starts to replace modernism with a more categoric rejection of the idea of the intrinsic meaning of any talk about anything. The idea that everything that we perceive in the world is not authentic, but is simply our own perception of something that is objectively unmeasurable. We also find, again following the postmodernists, the decline of the modernist idea of returning to point zero. Each of these earlier transformations that coincided with the beginnings of different Muslim centuries had represented for the European consciousness, as it moved away from God and away from truth, the extension of the Protestant model of returning to the source, away from a biblical text and towards history itself, so that everything had to redefine itself in terms of point zero. Communists and the French revolutionists and the artists and the architects all wanted to go back before civilization and to reinvent everything from scratch. In the case of architecture, this was manifested in the mid-20th century, I suppose, mid-14th century, with people like Walter Gropius and the Bauhaus movement, and the complete rejection of the traditional forms of Western architecture, an attempt to return to pure form as facilitated for the first time by the invention of modern materials. With the beginning of the 15th century, our 15th century, we find that modernism has been discredited, partly because there seemed to be something too programmatic and idealistic about the return to point zero, and the fact that people found its sterility uncongenial. And there was an attempt to open what one architect, Richard Merkin, has called the big closet. That is to say, we can learn from the past, and the past in all of its forms, whether the Romanesque or the Byzantine or the Moorish or the Hispanic or whatever, all there in the big closet of human civilization, and we can take out of that closet those things that happen to amuse us. So with Robert Venturi and Richard Rogers and a number of more explicitly postmodern architects, we find that the Western city, which shapes the Western soul, inevitably influencing our souls as well, is no longer modernist, but postmodern. But that much further away from tradition, because these forms have been stripped of any sacred meaning that they might once have had. Similarly, with the end of the 1300s, we find the collapse of socialism in the West, motivated in part by the disillusionment with the communist and hardline socialist project. Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, published in 1973, and now the complete collapse of any serious socialism anywhere in the Western world. Tony Blair's New Labour is not socialist at all. It's Labour without the socialism. It's a very postmodern kind of concept. In fact, it's a kind of straightforward social democracy. So these are the stages through which the West culture has evolved, and the West education has reflected this. In the post-Burkean world, we find that no longer was education explicitly dictated by purely sacred or Christian concerns, but it was more about personal growth. And there was a rediscovery of the Greek idea of greatness of soul, of human completeness, as being the function and purpose of education. There was still a certain transcendentalism attached to it. It was believed that human beings through education can become noble as well as useful. So Alfred North Whitehead said that education is the transmission of culture to enable individuals and society to attain a quality of life which is always beyond the mere facts of life. There's still, despite his very vague theism of process metaphysics that he espoused, an idea that this is about making us more than mere cogs in the cosmic or social machine. However, we can say that in the 15th century, secular educationalists have become unhappy even with this. Increasingly, the approach now is to regard education as, if anything, a vehicle for social progress. Not so much towards class equality, something that has been tried and simply has not succeeded, but towards other forms of equality, such as gender equality, and also the equality of people of different races, different sexual orientations. So modern education can be defined very simply as an acculturation against tradition. It's an explicitly polemical, transformational model of social engineering, despite its expressed opposition to all forms of totalitarian interference with the minds of the young. In fact, it is very programmatic, and its intention is explicitly to deconstruct tradition, to venture into the unknown. Now, this was fine when it was still assumed that we could have an objective definition of man. The modernist, I suppose, with a postmodern definition, that definition might well be rooted in psychoanalysis, or it might be rooted in some form of biologism. It might, for residual Marxists, be rooted in ideas of class consciousness. But that idea that modern education has succeeded in framing an objective conception of man now can be seen to have largely receded, creating serious problems for those who advocate programmatic models of social engineering. There's, of course, a great tension between modern epistemology, on the one hand, and ideologies such as traditional different feminism, on the other hand, or the gay liberation movement. There's a tension there that they're constantly arguing about. So we find in this new period that the idea that life has meaning and the purpose of education is to help us discern and live by that meaning has been progressively abandoned. Despite the importance of compulsory education in modern societies, the objective of education has been more vague and more negotiable, more relative. So, for instance, Peters, in his famous book, Education as Initiation, almost a Bible for many educationalists nowadays, says, "The great teacher is he who can convey a sense of quality of life to another so that it haunts his every endeavour and makes him fret and yearn to fix what he thinks and feels in a fitting form. For life has no one purpose, man imprints purposes upon it." Classic modern, postmodernist or Heideggerian epistemology. Now the problem with this is that it still uses words like quality of life. And that presupposes some consensus or at least clarity about what a good life might consist in. Can the modern world really define that? what are we here for? Well, religion has stepped away from answering that question, so we have to define it in terms of the good life, perhaps in Aristotelian terms. But what is a good life, and who is a good person? Are there virtues? We still speak of virtues in the modern world, as opposed to relative values. Clearly there's a diminishing consensus. Hence we can speak of the most profound crisis that the West has ever known in the theory of education. Since the 1960s, and certainly since the beginning of the new Muslim century, there has been a progressive, apparently unstoppable disintegration of values. There is an increasingly mechanistic image of human beings, and we might say that the Promethean project of Western education, which began in the 18th century with people like Burke as a resistance to the certainties of Christianity, has now reached its logical and destructive conclusion, so that the schools are no longer producing men and women of virtue. They no longer claim to do that, because nobody knows what a virtuous person is. All they can claim to do is to produce people who are not socially destabilizing. That's what they hope to do. In reality, they often don't succeed in doing even that. The idea of the delinquent, so unimaginable to traditional societies, which assumed that one's teenage years were a time of slightly uncertain quietness and submissiveness to one's parents. Nowadays, we have an idea of the delinquent who is paradigmatically in revolt against his parents, against religion, against authority, perhaps against the state, against community. So the traditional ideas have been completely inverted, and a new type of product is emerging from the mass education systems of the modern world. The only certainty we do have is, of course, the body. The mind, well, philosophy doesn't really help us to define any certainties, so the mind isn't very helpful. The spirit, abandoned almost completely, except in residually Christian schools, and except in New Age circles, which redefine spirit so radically as to make it almost a different concept, because they have no concept of the ego or nafs. There's no idea that the spirit is something that is held back by the nafs in New Age spirituality. It's all about self-discovery, self-proclamation. It's in fact the inversion of traditional spirituality. But the certainty that they do still have is the body. And it's all about the body. It's all about excelling in sport, that coming ultimately out of the ancient Greeks. The body beautiful. Young people figuring out what cosmetic surgery they're going to pay for, even before the relevant body parts are actually formed. So young kids in England now logging onto websites when they're 10 or 11 to work out what shape they want to have for their bodies, even before their bodies have begun to grow. This is increasingly common, and will become increasingly common. The body is the only certainty now. Man is regarded as an extremely sophisticated biological machine. Metaphysics has become myth. So what was tangential has become central, and what was central has become forgotten altogether, and modern education can do nothing whatsoever to stand against that. There may be a few Catholic schools that are fighting the rearguard action, but basically the battle has been lost. And overwhelmingly the model of education in the modern world is about the inculcation of vocational training that will enable us to be useful in the world, and will also perhaps give us some insight into the aesthetic and cultural conditions of the past, although even that is becoming difficult, and young people increasingly find it unimaginable, impossible to imagine what life would have been like even 20 or 30 years ago. The sense of continuity, of empathy with the past, with one's ancestors, has been lost almost entirely. So this is the alternative system, and we can say in today's world, without fear of exaggeration, that there are basically just two systems surviving, because the only two civilizations, transnational, global civilizations that still contain to exist are the Islamic civilization, the civilization of secular modernity. Everything else has more or less surrendered to the latter. The other two civilizations that were taken seriously were South Asian Hindu civilization and Chinese civilization. Both of those have now adopted styles of education, apart from certain small ghettos, that are virtually indistinguishable from the Western norm, and may even be more Western than the Western norm insofar as they ideologize progress and material gain even more substantially than is the case in most Western schools, because of the ideology of development. So this is what we're up against, if you like, and this is also what has shaped us, because most of us have been through those schools, whether we've been brought up in the West or in the Islamic world. The mere fact of speaking the English language means that one really nearly speaks in those categories. And this has to be set against the Islamic understanding of education, which is rooted, as we saw before, in the Islamic understanding of man as being potentially the lowest of the low, as Salafi'l-Din, but through education, through remembrance, becoming potentially higher than the angels. Certainly, there is no common ground between Western anthropology and that of Islam, because we can never view the totality of the human creature as being essentially defined by the biological. What is the human creature? Again, we could use the Quranic definition and say, man is that creature before whom the angels justly bow down in worship. Could be a definition. Now, Iblis, alayhi lana, saw only the clay. We were created of tinin lazib, clinging clay, apparently the basis matter in creation. And Iblis could only see the clay. He sees the physical stuff of our being. And he says, that is man, and not really worth bowing down to. So Iblis, if you like, is the paradigm of the modern educational theorist. Because Iblis, alayhi la'na, is saying precisely what the modern educationist is saying, which is that man is just a lump of clay. So, right, again, at the very beginning of Al-Qur'an al-Karim, we see this differentiation between the angelic and the bestial definition of the human condition. A definition and a battle which has been lost in the West and which we are struggling to continue to win in the Muslim Ummah. Again, to go back to the first of our three falls, or three expulsions, the image of man, is that man is the one who has been taught. He's the one who عَلَّمَ آدَمَ الْأَسْمَاءَ كُلَّهَا. He taught Adam all of the names. And this is what made him the Khilafah. We've seen this already. And so Jalaluddin Rumi, قَدَّسَ اللَّهُ سِرَّهُ, actually has a name for Adam, and he calls him عَلَّمَ الْأَسْمَاءَ, kind of Turkish composite phrase. He is the Lord as he taught the names. That is what makes us lordly in the world, because we have the names. What are these names? We could say that a name, these objects of the first act of education in human history, a name here means the discursive, conceptualized knowledge of a thing. And that is what no other order of creation has. A cow, or a dog, or a tree has no name for anything. Occasionally, certain higher forms of creation can engage in certain primitive forms of speech, but there is no indication that they have names. In other words, they cannot conceptualize, they cannot have an abstract understanding of the meaning or essence of another phenomenon of existence. So this is the knowledge of the shadows of the Zulumat. And it's not the knowledge of the that, but it is the knowledge of the divine names, because the true names of phenomena in existence are not the names that human beings have conventionally dreamed up for those phenomena, but are the names that Allah himself has applied to them. Sometimes we can know these through revelation. And our ability to give names, to be educated to give names to the phenomena of the manifest world, originates in the first moment of our existence as conscious naming beings, which is indicated in the Quran. This great verse where Allah takes, before their engendering in the world, the children of Adam, the Zurriya, the soul, before their being enfleshed, and Ashhadahum ala anfusihim, made them bear witness upon themselves, testify to themselves, and he said, أَلَسْتُ بِرَبِّكُمْ, am I not your Lord? قَالُوا بَلَا شَهِدْنَا, they said, we said, yes, indeed, we bear witness, you are our Lord. And this was, lest you should say, on the Yawm al-Qiyamah, that as if we were unaware. كُنَّا عَنْ هَذَا غَافِلِينَ. So, that is the kind of primordial proto-education, if you like, that even predates the ta'aleem that Sayyidina Adam received as the kalimat, and as the name. And we can say that from that point we are educated human beings, and hence all education in the world is a re-education. It's a reclamation of what we already know. Now, we knew it jumlatan, globally, generally. We didn't know it tafsilan, we didn't know all of the details. But it's the big picture that counts. Now, Adam, alayhi salam, is in this the prototype of all humanity in the processes of education, inculcation, because in him we were present at that primordial covenant, the day of Alastu bi Rabbikum. So Adam becomes the repository of all knowledge. And to the extent that we know, to the extent that we say Shahidna, we can be said to be Adamic, to have retained our Adamic form. So to learn in the Quranic perspective is not about progress at all. It's not about moving forward, of discovering the unknown. It's about moving back. Religion is reactionary. We like to go back because we know that goodness is at our source, not at the periphery. And our Adamic nature is the nature to which we wish to return, because it's the fitrah with which we were born. Let me just finish this contrasting of the Western and the traditional Islamic understanding of man and the process of education with some further verses by Sayyidina Jalal ad-Din Rumi, greatest of all of our poets, where he says, the father of mankind, who is the master of, he taught the names, has hundreds of thousands of knowledges in his every vein. His soul was taught the name of every single thing exactly as that thing is until its end. Whatever title God gave never changed. He whom God calls nimble did not become slow. Whoever will be a believer in the end was seen by Adam at the beginning. Whoever will become an unbeliever at the end appeared to him. For us, the name of each thing is its outward form. For the Creator, the name of each thing is its inward mystery. For Musa, the name of his rod was Asa, staff. For the Creator, its name was serpent. And that's why in Islam, learning, ta'allum, is a form of ibadah, of worshipful slavehood to our Maker. Because it's no different to any other of the ibadat. It proclaims our ubudiyyah. To learn is not in a different category from to prostrate or to fast. Because all of them are processes of returning, of regaining what we have lost, of reminding ourselves. As we learn, we regain Adam's status of knower of the knowledges of the world. I think at this point, time for lunch. I'll stop there, but there is much more that could be said, because the subject of education, of course, relates to every other aspect of our religion. Most profoundly, it relates to our understanding of who and what we are. But it also relates to our understanding of where we are and when we are. Issues that we often tend to forget. If we are truly to frame an Islamic education for ourselves, for our communities, for the world, da'wah, of course, a form of education, then we really have to understand what is the civilization that we are up against, how profound are the differences that separate our very exalted view of the human condition and the false humanism of modernity. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.